Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Does Dick Cheney have too much power? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 5 days after last weekend's shooting accident, President Bush said Vice President Cheney's handling of it was just fine with him. But during the interim, it appeared there was growing tension between their staffs. Outside the White House, even Republicans are asking if Cheney's unprecedented power and independence are damaging to the president. On To the Point, has Cheney become a sort of co-president, whose penchant for secrecy makes him unaccountable to the public? If the president wants it that way, does it really matter? On Reporter's Notebook later on, how widespread are hostilities between blacks and Latinos in American cities? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Vice President Cheney spoke very briefly today about last week's shooting of his hunting companion in Texas. On To the Point, does Cheney's handling of the accident reveal a degree of independence that could damage President Bush? If the president doesn't see it that way, how much does it matter? On Reporter's Notebook, Los Angeles County jails have been rocked with racial violence. Black and Latino commentators say the hostilities go well beyond prison walls. First, this news update. On the Philippine island of Leyte, an entire village, including an elementary school, is covered in 30 feet of mud. Residents had evacuated after days of heavy rain, but when the rain stopped, they came home to encounter a massive landslide. Out of a population of 1,857, almost 1,800 are missing. Dr. David Petley is director of the International Landslide Center at Durham University in Great Britain. Dr. Petley, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Are the Philippines vulnerable, particularly vulnerable, to this kind of incident?
Yes, they are, very much so. A combination of rapid population growth. There are just too many people to occupy the land, and also the cutting down of the forests. And then we have a climate that means a very heavy rainfall quite frequently. So landslides are very common indeed.
Tell us more about the forests. I take it there's been great deforestation there. Over how long a period of time has that taken place?
Well, actually, the deforestation has probably occurred over the last 250 years or so. But in recent times, the pace of deforestation has accelerated as populations are growing quickly and people are relatively poor. So we have multiple pressures of needing firewood and needing money to just pay for the basic commodities. So deforestation is very rapid indeed.
So how does that relate to mudslides?
Well, the forest does two things to help the stability of the slope. The first is that the trees themselves take water out of the slope, and most landslides are caused by water being present as a result of heavy rainfall. And the second thing is that the trees bind the soil together. So remove the trees and you have more water and weaker soil, and it's really a recipe for disaster.
Has there also been mining in that area?
Yes, there has been mining, and the mining activities are frequently at the bottom of the slope, and that effectively makes the slope rather steeper. And so, again, that increases the chances of a landslide happening.
So the vulnerability then is growing, and more people are moving into the areas where they are most at risk?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, landslides often kill the very poorest people in society because those are the ones who live on the most marginal land. The richer, more affluent people move into the areas of safer terrain, displacing the poor people. And as their families grow, they're in more and more dangerous locations.
Talking again with Dr. David Petley at the International Landslide Center at Durham University in Britain. Well, you mentioned climate. What about climate? And to what extent is climate change, do you think, making this a more perilous situation?
Well, this has been a very controversial topic for a number of years, and we've been trying to work out for a while whether climate change is a major factor. Most landslides are caused by heavy rain, and so if the climate is changing, there is a chance. We've been collecting data over the last few years, and we now have a very strong link between warm temperatures on Earth and the number of landslide fatalities. When the global temperatures are high, more people die in landslides. And the correlation, the relationship between the two is almost perfect. So we think that there is a very high chance that climate change is a major factor here.
The rescue effort apparently has stopped for the night, at least from the air, in Leyte, although they're still trying to dig people out of 30 feet of a very moist mud, apparently an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. I know you do a lot of work in providing assistance. What are they going to need there, do you think?
Well, one has to be very realistic here. Unfortunately, if you're more than about a foot under the mud, unless something is protecting you, there's very little chance of survival. Most people die in mudslides as a result of the weight of the mud compressing their chest. And so more than about a foot, and you literally can't breathe and you die quite quickly. And so the only chance, really, of people being brought out of this alive now is if they've been in a building or a structure that's protected them from the mud. But there'll be many people who whose houses have been destroyed who, in fact, weren't in the village at the time. Those people will have lost literally everything. And so they'll need the most basic commodities to allow them to survive, some shelter, food and clean water. Otherwise, we see a second round of disasters as people's health deteriorates under those conditions.
How quickly does the mud come down?
Sometimes very fast indeed. This is a very large landslide. It probably moved more than a mile or so. And in those cases, the speed that the landslide can move can be faster than a car on the freeway.
A car speed of a car on the freeway?
Yeah, that's right. So really, at times, we may see speeds of 60 miles an hour. We have recorded cases where speeds have reached 200 miles an hour. So if you're in the way of one of these things, there is little chance of escaping.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. Again, out of a population of 1,857, we're told that some 1,800 still are missing. Hopefully many of those will be people who were out of town at the time. In the meantime, Dr. Petley, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, Dr. David Petley, director of the International Landslide Center at Durham University in Britain. In a moment, does Dick Cheney have too much power on To the Point?
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. 6 days after the shooting accident in Texas, Vice President Cheney mentioned it very briefly during a speech today in Wyoming. He said it's been a long week and that he's very glad his friend Harry Whittington is on the mend. Outside the hospital in Corpus Christi, Whittington spoke to reporters. He was dressed in a coat and tie. His face was swollen, but he said he felt fine, that accidents do happen, and that he was sorry the vice president and his family had to worry about him when they had to deal with situations that are so much more serious. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for the Liberal Nation magazine. He's also author of Dick, The Man Who Is President, about the vice president. John Nichols, as always, welcome to our program.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Certainly the vice president does have more serious things to worry about. A lot of his supporters are saying that this incident has received a lot more attention than it's worth because the liberal press hates Mr. Cheney. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that there are a lot of reporters who don't like Dick Cheney all that much. I would suggest that there's probably no reporter who dislikes Dick Cheney as much as Dick Cheney dislikes the media. So it's a mutual misadmiration society or whatever we want to refer to it as. But look, the bottom line on all of this controversy this last week is that at best it can be seen as a metaphor, not as as something that is a particularly serious development as regards the vice president. With this incident, we did see a lot of the vice president's biggest problems. He is intensely secretive. He does often seem to operate as if he is above or outside of the law, and he is very scornful of scrutiny, not only by the media, but also by the Congress and certainly ordinary citizens. And so you did see a lot of legitimate reasons to criticize the vice president, but I do think things got way out of control as regards, you know, the hunting accident, the incident itself. And Harry Whittington, actually today, proved to be quite a remarkable class act, and I think probably has tamped down that particular controversy. Now, hopefully, with this renewed attention of the vice president, we'll be able to focus on some of the much more serious issues involving what really are the abuses of his office and what really is the excessive power that is concentrated within it.
What's excessive about it, if, as appears to be the case, it's fine with President Bush?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's certainly true that throughout history, presidents have ceded vast areas of responsibility to others within their administration. Gerald Ford, by all accounts, handed foreign policy over to Henry Kissinger for the better part of 2 years. And so we know that happens. But what's troubling with Dick Cheney is that he essentially has run U.S. foreign policy for the last 4 or 5 years. And if he was doing so in the sort of very public light that Kissinger ran foreign policy back in the 70s, I think that, you know, some people might like it, some might dislike it, but it would be appropriate. The problem with Cheney is he has so much power, and he exercises it usually without much attention and with very little press scrutiny. Remember, he was down in Texas on this hunting trip with no media traveling with him at all. That is quite remarkable. I mean, usually we would...
Why would the press go on a hunting trip?
Well, because the press follows, in a country where the media covers those who have power, say, you know, many of the other countries, democracies around the world, not the United States, but in a country where the media actually is interested in who is exercising authority over the operations of the government, you would have reporters who would travel with Cheney wherever he went. Remember that when Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Great Britain, travels, he's always got reporters with him. And he is not the Prime Minister, but he's a very powerful man. I think this is a failure on the part of U.S. media to pay anywhere near the attention to Cheney that his actions and his power merit.
So you're saying then that because the press doesn't pay more attention, the vice presidency is able to conduct, to make policy effectively, secretly, and without accountability.
That's exactly right. Now, remember, I have never suggested and would never suggest that George Bush is a puppet in all this. I think the way to understand the relationship between Cheney and Bush is as a partnership. President Bush knows that he is not particularly experienced in areas of defense policy and foreign policy, and so he has ceded a great deal of responsibility there. Famously, in Bob Woodward's book, there is the incident where Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador, is briefed by Cheney about the Iraq war, but then says, well, I have to talk to the president on this one. It's such a big deal. And so shortly thereafter, he gets a call from President Bush, who says, I understand you need to talk to me. And Bandar says, yeah, I need to talk to you about this Iraq thing. And Bush says, did you talk to Dick Cheney? Bandar says, yes. And then Bush says, well, then you know everything I know. And I think that really sums things up. Cheney is dominant.
John Nichols, again, a Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. Ellie Krakowski is a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. He's been in and out of government since September 11th. He's consulted with the Pentagon and foreign governments on strategies in the war on terror, certainly something of great interest to the vice president. And Mr. Krakowski, welcome to you.
A pleasure to be with you again.
Do you think that the vice president has enough power?
Well, I have to tell you that I find this whole thing, it's a sort of a almost obsessive compulsive type of a fascination with things that that I find well, I'm not sure how to describe them in any nice fashion. We have a system that is very very open. There is accountability. The president is ultimately responsible. He has advisors. The vice president is a clear position defined. What power the vice president has is clearly a function of what the president chooses to assign to him. Mr. Cheney is an extremely qualified individual. I think that a great deal of what there is a sort of a fascination with procedure, whether there are reporters covering every single second of a hunting trip or not. I just fail to see what all the noise is all about. I think the system is working quite well. The vice president is a very qualified person, and the president chooses to ask him advice. This business of excessive power is, to me, something that is so utterly incomprehensible. I just don't see what the question is.
All right.
I can tell you, I know people who work with the vice president. I don't think it's anywhere near what people say. I think he's very cautious in what he does, in the advice he does. I know there are certain things people don't want to touch who work for him, other things they do want to touch. Everything seems to me no more, no less than other things. He just happens to be a very qualified individual, and the president relies on his advice.
Alec Rakowski again at the American Foreign Policy Council. Back to John Nichols with The Nation magazine. During this past week, there have been some reports that there are Republicans concerned about the independence of the vice president in the context of their fear that it might actually damage the president. How many Republicans are you aware of who feel that way?
Well, I think there's quite a few. Let's be clear that Chuck Hagel, the senator from Nebraska, who entertains notions of running for the presidency, has been very blunt about Cheney. In fact, I think yesterday in a meeting with a group of reporters, rather aggressively tore into Cheney, suggesting that the vice president, if he had not gotten deferments that allowed him not to serve in Vietnam, might have known how to use a gun, and then saying quite a few other tough things about the Veep. He's not alone. There's no question that a number of members of Congress, people like Richard Lugar, the chairman of the Senate committee that deals with foreign affairs, have in various settings expressed discomfort with a sense that the vice president has a strategy, an approach that he wants to follow that may or may not be the best one for the Republicans or the best one for the administration, and a sense that he is perhaps far more influential than folks would like him to be. Now, I do believe your other guest makes the point exactly right. The president has ceded a great deal of authority to the vice president. Some Republicans are comfortable with that, some are not. Where I always come back to, though, is this notion that if someone has the amount of authority that the vice president has, that he clearly has on so many foreign policy issues, then there ought to be much more intense scrutiny. And I do believe that that's where the Republican concerns about him may come into play, because as there is increased scrutiny on the administration, I think much of the anger, the discomfort, the frustration of both Republicans and Democrats will be focused on the vice president. It is, frankly, easier. I mean, he's an easier target. And it is also, I would argue, more appropriate, because he is the person you really want to kind of delve into if you want to figure out how this administration operates on an awfully lot of issues.
John Nichols with The Nation saying again that the press doesn't cover Vice President Cheney enough. We've just been joined by one of the good friends of Dick Cheney. He himself, a former senator, Republican from Wyoming, Alan Simpson. Senator, good to have you with us.
It's always a treat to do NPR. We out in the Wild West, in the Athens of the West here in Cody, we love NPR. It's a great thing and for a rural state to the you know, there's only 500,000 of us wandering around in 100,000 square miles, so NPR is a very key part of Wyoming.
Glad we're able to give you a sense of connection to the rest of the world. What do you say to what we're hearing here, that the vice president not only has a great deal of authority, and nobody's arguing with the president's having given him that, but that he is so secretive, never having held a press conference, that he's essentially unaccountable to the voters in this democracy. Are you worried about that?
No, but I know many in the Fourth Estate are. They've had a belly full of Dick Cheney long ago, and the reason is because he's rather dismissive of them. He doesn't get on and chat them up. He doesn't call them and slip cover your fanny, and he doesn't give them enough, because he's when we ran together and we served together in Congress for 10 years, he was the most accessible, affable guy with any reporter, from the Casper Star to the Moorcroft Gazette. and then in Congress he was part of the leadership and he was available. And then where it turned off, in my mind, I have not talked with Dick Cheney, and I think that's important. My heart breaks, because I'd love to talk to him, but I've had enough people calling me from the media who were wondering if I have talked to him and if he gave me any guidance of what to say. How do you like that one? How do you like that for journalistic twist? So I haven't called him, even though I'd love to, and I will when I finish all this stuff. But I think
why is he? You said he was very accessible in his past.
Why
isn't he more so now?
Where it ended was when he and Colin Powell, during the first Gulf War, would twice a week with Pete Williams there, have press conferences and field what has to be described as the stupidest questions ever fired at a defense secretary, like, when will you attack, and where will the point of attack, and how many forces will you have? Well, no wonder you smile when you're dealing with the media. I mean, you got to have rock for brains to ask questions like that of a military exercise. And I think right there he thought, you know, if I have to waste time like this, I'm not going to do it. Then the Halliburton thing, the votes in the House when he was nominated, all the stuff is a perfect storm. And now this one, when you not only have they don't like him, and then you have people who don't like people who kill birds and use guns. And man, oh man, here we go. This is absolutely the height of zeal and that he was, and that Chuck Hagel says he doesn't know how to shoot. Good Lord, he could shoot rings around Chuck Hagel. He's an expert shot. He's gets two doves with one shot.
All right, I understand what you're saying, but let me get you back to the issue of the policy making function that he has. And even if he is dismissive of the press, even if some reporters do ask him stupid questions, and one would have to concede, I'm sure that they have. Still, there is in a democracy, is there not, an important function of by the press, and it has to do with accountability to the voters. And if he has that much power, doesn't he have a responsibility to make himself more available?
Well, who is it that keeps babbling about his power? If he were doing anything that this president didn't want, he wouldn't do it.
So that's the issue then.
Has anybody figured this out, that if Dick Cheney were continually doing things with his awesome arrogance and power, well, where in the hell was the president? And I know the president enough to know that if he said, Dick, enough of that, that would be the end of it. That's what he did when he was chief of staff of a president of the United States at the age of 34. Where does all this guff come from?
You don't think, then, that he really does have that kind of power, or that the only issue is whether the president wants him to?
Dick Cheney is one of the most savvy politic and political too, but politic, that's a great word, men I've ever known. He would never intrude or step on any message that the president of the United States didn't want him to do. Now, that's all I can tell you. From intimate knowledge of Dick Cheney, from 40 years. So in my line of work, in 18 years, it didn't matter what I did in reality. It was all perception. The perception started way back then when he, quote, found his way to be nominated vice president, must have talked the president into that. Hell, he didn't want to do it at all. He rejected it four times, and finally the president said, I don't want you to bring anybody else in here. I want you. And then it started. Here's this Machiavellian, this sinister background figure with a sneer, this unbelievable blackguard, this guy with a red tail sticking out of his bum and cloven hooves and horns. You know,
right.
What the hell?
Senator Alan Simpson, we're out of time for this portion of our program. Thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure. I enjoy it very much.
Former U.S. Senator from Wyoming. We'll be back in a moment to talk more about Dick Cheney on Reporter's Notebook. How widespread are hostilities between blacks and Latinos in American cities? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Talking today about Vice President Cheney, the amount of power that he holds, whether he is in fact accountable, or whether it doesn't matter because the President of the United States wants him to do exactly what he is doing. Tom Donnelly is resident fellow in defense and national security studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's author of Operation Iraqi Freedom, a strategic assessment. His association with Dick Cheney goes way back. And Tom Donnelly, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren. Nice to be with you again.
I know that you, as far as policy goals are concerned, are in full agreement with the vice president. But do you think that he has handled himself in a way that has in every respect performed in a way that has he performed in every respect in a way the president would want him to?
Well, he certainly performed at the president's pleasure. I really don't see any question about that. And, you know, part of the other half of the Dick Cheney is the evil genius of the Bush administration, is the presumption that the president's a bit of a nincompoop and needs to have adult supervision. And I think, you know, both of those tropes are... Yeah.
Well, another way
are misleading.
A more flattering way to put it is that we've gotten a sort of co-presidency, and as was said earlier, the president himself didn't have a lot of experience in Washington when he first came. He obviously was delighted to have the vice president available because of that. Do we have a co-presidency?
No. I mean, a lot of Republican politicians would have been happy to have Dick Cheney beside them. He's a fantastically popular figure amongst the Republican faithful, and there are pretty good political reasons to want to stay close to Dick Cheney, as well as his obvious long experience in government. All these things are contributing factors, but all that said, and despite the fact that he's certainly more influential than a lot of recent vice presidents. There really is only one president, and if Dick Cheney is saying something important, it's because the president said it was okay.
But as I understand it, you give him mixed reviews. So tell us why.
Well, there are some substantive issues, and I think there are certainly many areas, particularly in relation to Secretary Rumsfeld, where there's a reasonable amount of friction between the vice president and his staff. Less so between Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld. Personally, they go back a long way together, but there are significant policy differences. I was in a conversation with one of the vice president's staffers just a couple days ago in which they were complaining about their inability to, affect the way the Defense Department is running things in Iraq. So certainly, if you look at it, from their eyes, there's a level of frustration at their limitations rather than this, all-powerful figure that is portrayed in the media.
So is that important, then, to those who say that the vice president has more power than he ought to or than other vice presidents have? Does he have to share it with Secretary Rumsfeld?
I think factually that is the case, and I would personally say I wish he were exercising a little bit more adult supervision on the Secretary of Defense, because I'm, not, as you've heard me say in the past, not real pleased with the way the war in Iraq is being conducted, and I wish the White House were exercising more supervision rather than less over that.
So you think, then, that Vice President Cheney should have more power than he does?
Well, certainly in this area. I mean, again, it's the policy outcome I really care about, really, it is the president's job as commander-in-chief to oversee the actual conduct of the policy that he sets forth. But given Mr. Cheney's, wisdom and obvious stature and what I believe to be his pretty good common sense about policy in Iraq, I wish he had more power. That's a shorthand way of putting it.
Tom Donnelly, formerly with the Project for the New American Century, which he served with the vice president before he was vice president, Tom Donnelly, now at the American Enterprise Institute. Back to John Nichols, the nation's Washington correspondent. Interested in what your take is on what we just heard from Tom Donnelly, that Secretary Rumsfeld really is the one in charge of the war, not the vice president at all.
Well, I would suggest to you that the Rumsfeld-Cheney relationship is one of the most fascinating in political history. Remember, Cheney attached himself to Rumsfeld back in the 60s and really rose as Rumsfeld's aide-de-camp. And yes, they have had some parting of the ways. Some people think the parting of the ways actually came in 2000 when Cheney chose himself rather than Rumsfeld to be Bush's running mate. But the bottom line is this. Unlike your guest, I tend to be one of those who believes that Dick Cheney has gotten everything wrong on the war in Iraq, beginning with his statement 2 days before the war began on Meet the Press that American troops would be greeted as liberators. And the notion that he could somehow exercise more adult supervision or do a better job than Rumsfeld, I think, is a comic game. The fact of the matter is this administration certainly has the power to force Donald Rumsfeld to do as they choose. They have not, because they have no plan. There is no clear agenda. There's no sort of sense of what to do in Iraq. And Rumsfeld is managing it within the parameters that have been set. Now,
I'm sorry, John Nichols, I'm going to interrupt you because I have another guest I need to bring into this conversation. First, though, let me go back to Tom Donnelly. Obviously, you and John Nichols disagree about the reason for the war in the first place. But what about this stress between Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld? Do you think it goes back to the year 2000? Did Rumsfeld want to be vice president?
That's something I don't have a whole lot of insight on, you know, in terms of the selection process of who became Mr. Bush's vice president. If, you know, Don Rumsfeld's an ambitious guy, also a man with a great record of public service, but clearly their collegial and long-term friendship has survived not only, you know, the disagreements such as they are over Iraq, but obviously they survived their competition to become vice president, if there was one.
Tom Donnelly at the American Enterprise Institute. Andrew Rudalovich is an associate professor of political science at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He's author of The New Imperial Presidency, Renewing Presidential Power After Watergate. Professor Rudalovich, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
What about Dick Cheney compared to vice presidents of the past? Have we ever seen anything like this?
Well, you have to understand that historically the vice presidency has been an office filled with ciphers, an insignificant office sought by insignificant men, as one historian put it. And this is in part because the Constitution really creates an odd office. It creates a legislative office, you could argue, primarily, in that the vice president is the president of the Senate. That's really his only job in the Constitution. That is, unless the president is incapacitated, of course, or if the president dies.
So that means he wields the gavel, but the only time he actually does anything is when there is a tie vote and he can break the tie.
That's the only time he votes, right. Some vice presidents have exercised some sort of agenda-setting authority in the Senate, but not very much. It hasn't been something that we've seen build up over time. The Congress has been too jealous of its own prerogatives to let the vice president run the show there for the most part.
So is it true, then, that the power of any vice president depends on the president?
I think that's very true. The office, again, had been fairly insignificant, except for when the occupants became president themselves. It's not until really after Spiro Agnew is forced to resign, and you begin to see the shift right in the mid-70s, that the vice presidency begins to take on more responsibilities. Remember, even Harry Truman taking over for Franklin Roosevelt was not told about the atomic bomb before he became president. So vice presidents were operating in something of a vacuum. They were expected to be able to take over, but not equipped to do so necessarily. It's really Nelson Rockefeller, oddly, who as Gerald Ford's vice president demands more policy-making authority. He becomes the chair of the Domestic Policy Council, and he battles at that time against Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, who are the White House staffers who want to make sure that a vice president does not exercise independent authority. So Dick Cheney's history in this area is hard-earned, right? He knows how these things work, and he's been on the other side.
Of course, Ford was the person who followed Spiro Agnew, the first vice president for Richard Nixon, and was appointed to the job to replace Agnew. He then was elected in his own right, but it was—
Ford was not, no.
I'm sorry, he was never elected in his own right. Excuse me. I misspoke. So he was in a particularly weak position, one would think, as a president, never having been elected.
He was, and so I think from the White House staff's point of view, they wanted to make sure that any policy making within the administration was clearly attributed to the president, not to the vice president.
So now we have Cheney.
Right. Well, and this is a case where President Bush, I think, has been very comfortable in delegating that power. He has integrated the vice presidential staff quite closely with his own White House staff. He has clearly relied on the vice president as a key advisor and as really as a staff member in a way that previous presidents have not quite been willing to do. Now, that works, obviously, for President Bush. He's been at least not publicly critical of the way the vice president has operated and in fact, publicly quite effusive in his praise. But I would, if Senator Simpson were still on the line, I would remind him of a line he's used about elected officials' relationships with their staff. He uses a biblical quote, "Jacob died leaning on his staff," which I think is important in this case in that the vice president is not somebody you can fire, right? This is not somebody who is below the radar the way the White House staff can be. The White House staff, it's argued, should have a, quote, passion for anonymity. And if you think of somebody like Andy Card, who really does operate quietly and in the president's interest, that's not quite the way that the vice president can operate, given his wider scope of duties, but also his prominence.
And yet, Vice President Cheney, as pointed out by John Nichols, has been able to operate pretty much under the radar, in part by his own design. As Senator Simpson said, he apparently thinks that the press asks stupid questions. But is that really the issue? Isn't the question here that he is operating without accountability as a very powerful figure?
Well, any member of the government is accountable eventually to the president. And so the president is the one in our system who's held accountable in the executive branch for the kinds of decision that the executive makes. I think the broader question of secrecy is well worth exploring, though. Clearly, the vice president feels strongly that the move towards openness in government and towards the Congress's ability to extract information from the executive branch, again, especially starting in the 1970s after Watergate and Vietnam, you know, went far too far. He has been very adamant that the executive branch really doesn't owe Congress anything in the way of disclosure or in the way of dissemination of information. And there, I think, perhaps he has not served the president well.
Andrew
Rudolph, the advice he's giving.
Andrew Rudolph, excuse me for interrupting you, at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Back to our first guest, John Nichols, at the Nation magazine. Do you think now that perhaps as in part a result of the shooting incident that the press will spend more time trying to scrutinize the vice president, whether he likes it or not?
I think so, and it's an interesting development. You know, it's funny, I was thinking back to something Senator Simpson said about, you know, sort of dismissive of the press's role here. And I don't think that politicians should ever be in a position of deciding how much they get covered. And I think it's the media's job to make those calls. And so I don't blame Dick Cheney. I don't care what his attitude is. I think the media has tended to, because it's easier to focus more on the president. Now that the vice president has really spun into this kind of very complex personal scandal controversy zone that the Washington press corps seems to like so much, I think that he will get sort of a Tom DeLay treatment. Whatever he does, he will be paid more attention to. I expect when he travels around the country to campaign for individual candidates, which he does a lot, there will be more of a press contingent, more scrutiny.
Very quickly, Professor, what do you think about the future? It has been said, various presidential candidates, Clinton being among them, has said, and he made good on it to a certain extent, that they were going to make the vice president a more important figure than he'd been in the past. Do you think this will continue? Will the next president say that Dick Cheney didn't have enough power, my vice president's going to be have even more?
I think we may have reached the limits of that particular promise. I can't imagine a vice president being more powerful than Vice President Cheney is, but I think we will continue to see a balancing, not so much of region or age as we used to see, but of inside and outside. We've picked our presidents recently from sort of a group that comes outside Washington, governors and other outsiders, and they need some kind of inside experience. That role has been filled by vice presidents and probably will be.
Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Andrew Rudovelich, the president, associate professor of political science at Dickinson College. His book, The New Imperial Presidency, Renewing Presidential Power After Watergate. And John Nichols, his book is now out in paper. It's called The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney. It has a new title. Thanks to both of you, to Tom Donnelly, Ellie Krakowski, and Senator Alan Simpson as well for being on our program today. Two people have died in more than a week of bloody violence between blacks and Latinos in Los Angeles County jails. County Sheriff Lee Baca blames the trouble on gang members who've brought their grievances in off the streets. But the hostilities may be deeper and more extensive than that. More on a moment, in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. After some inmates were transferred to state prisons and others were temporarily segregated by race, the violence has died down in Los Angeles County jails. But hostility between blacks and Latino gang members is a fact of life, both inside and outside the walls. Earl Ofari Hutchinson is a nationally syndicated columnist, public radio host, civil rights activist, and author of several books, including The Crisis of Black and Black. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, good to have you back on our program.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
You have said many times now, and for a long period of time, that the hostility we're talking about does, in fact, go well beyond the walls of prisons. What's your evidence for that?
Several things. Number one, I look at the great debate now over illegal immigration and, of course, jobs. I can tell you, in a series that I've done recently on blacks, their attitudes toward illegal immigration, the hostility via email, faxes, phone calls, and letters that I've gotten to my column, the perception, all from blacks, by the way, the perception being that how dare you tilt toward undocumented workers, how dare you defend them, how dare you give a broader, and I like to think more nuanced, a balanced position on the great debate over illegal immigration and the effect it's having on African-American communities. That alerted me to something. It's not scientific, it's anecdotal, but that combined with the past clashes that we've seen in schools between African-American and Latinos, we saw major problems on the job site at King Drew Hospital going back during the years.
King Drew Hospital here in Los Angeles County. Go ahead.
Exactly. And also we've seen a number of problems within the unions between blacks and Latinos over jobs in the hospital industry, retail service industry, restaurant industry, and, of course, the janitorial services. All of these things taken together, and also to an extent, the unwillingness or seeming unwillingness on the part of so many African-American leaders and Latino leaders to step up to the plate, to try to reach across the divide on all of these hot-button issues. Now, this is not to say, Warren, that it's a doom-and-gloom picture completely, because in some neighborhoods on the ground, black and Latino activists, community residents, have worked together and cooperated, even on school issues, issues of police abuse and neighborhood services. But generally speaking, there does seem to be a lot of tension and friction on some of the great hot-button issues.
Earl Ofari Hutchinson, again, a nationally syndicated columnist and radio host. Nicholas Baca is an attorney based in Walnut Creek, California. That's up near San Francisco. And he's author of a book called The Presumed Alliance, The Unspoken Conflict Between Latinos and Blacks and What It Means for America. Mr. Baca, welcome back to you.
Well, thank you for having me on.
The title of your book seems to suggest that this is not just something that's located localized in Southern California.
No, I think it's a national phenomenon that we're seeing. I've also decided that perhaps we ought to change the titles, given what's been going on recently, to the not-so-unspoken conflict, because it seems to be coming out more and more frequently. We saw it with Mayor Ray Nagin in New Orleans when he was concerned about New Orleans being overrun by Mexicans. We've seen this in the job situation. There was an article in the January 26th edition of the Wall Street Journal talking about lawsuits being filed by African Americans against employers because of the preference of employers for Latinos over African Americans. We see it in the political arena where right now in Oakland you're having a Latino and African American running head to head for the mayoral position. You see it in the educational system. You see it in the employment situation. So it's not a phenomenon that's restricted to either California or to the prison systems.
Well, when it comes to speaking out, are Latinos speaking out as African Americans are?
No, I don't think so. And I think that there's a real reluctance on the part of the Latinos to come out and address this as an issue. You're having a real change in demographics, a sort of a realignment of power between the two groups. And I think to some degree, Latino leaders are a little uncomfortable with the new position that they've acquired. I think that it's to some degree also there's the remnants, the leftover of the civil rights movement, and the fact that African Americans were leaders in that era, and there's an idea that somehow Latinos are beholden to African Americans for whatever reasons because of their leadership during that period. So I agree. I don't think that Latinos and African American leaders are really addressing this as a significant issue.
But do Latinos feel the kind of hostility we heard described on the part of African Americans? And is that something that Latino leaders ought to be taking seriously?
I don't know that that's the case, because I know that when the 2000 census came out, and I was doing the research for my book, I logged on to the BET website, and I was just absolutely blown away by the kinds of comments that were registered by African Americans simply because Latinos had gotten this numerical superiority. In my book, I do talk about the fact that you have this antipathy on the part of Latinos towards African Americans. And I think, to be perfectly honest, let's be blunt about it, both groups have an antipathy towards each other. African Americans have racial stereotypes of Latinos, and Latinos have racial stereotypes of African Americans. The simple fact that we are both peoples of color doesn't prevent us from having these kind of very difficult and not very appealing positions towards each other.
Nicholas Vaca in Walnut Creek, California. Back to Earl Ofari Hutchinson. Would you agree that this goes beyond economics to politics, given the change in demography and the growing numbers of Latinos? Is that really what's behind it all?
Well, that's only one factor. Just to circle back a second on the cultural racial part of it, I remember back in August or July last year, major issue came up over the Mexican stamp. There was a stamp that was issued by the Mexican Postal Service, which unfavorably toward many African Americans, at least that was a view, depicted a black figure, which of course is an endearing figure in Mexico, Miguel Piguin. In a stamp in a very stereotypical manner. Well, that set off a big uproar. A lot of protests, a lot of letters were sent. Leaders did speak out. Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, had meetings with President Vicente Fox, pulled the stamp. That was essentially the message. But underneath that, once again, the whole issue of racial stereotyping and how blacks were seen in Mexico and also how blacks saw Mexicans here, that came out. There was a subtext there. Now, politics, I think we are seeing that in California 10 years ago, for example, African Americans made up a significant percentage of the California legislature. There were 10 or 11 African Americans in the state legislature. Today, that number is about half. Conversely, the number of Latino legislators was in the area of 15 to 20. Now it's up to about one-third of the state legislature. What many African Americans are saying, look, areas like South Los Angeles, and as Nicholas said, in Oakland and other areas of the state, San Diego, San Francisco, where African Americans at one time had some significant power, had mayoralships, had a significant presence on the city council and the state legislature, that's dwindling, that's diminishing. And I have to be honest, the finger is being pointed by many, many African Americans and Latinos.
Nicholas Vaca, back to you. You said that Latino leaders are somewhat uncomfortable for a number of reasons about discussing all of this, in part because the reality is that their numbers are increasing. Their political power, as Earl Ofari Hutchinson indicated, is increasing as well. Do they need to be more sensitive? Do they need to begin to reach out to African Americans simply because of their growing power?
I think that they have a certain obligation to the African-American population. I think that if, for example, if Ignacio de la Fuente becomes the mayor of Oakland, he has a certain degree of obligation to the African-American population to represent them as well as everybody else in Oakland.
And I should point out for those around the country who might recognize this name, he's running against Ron Dellums, who was one of the most powerful African-Americans to serve in the Congress of the United States. He was chair of the Armed Services Committee. Go ahead.
And that's correct. And in fact, he was drafted by African-Americans to come in and run against Ignacio de la Fuente. Up to the time that he entered the race, Ignacio de la Fuente was considered to be the front runner. So you have these two individuals poised to go against each other, similar to what you had in the 2001 mayoral race in Los Angeles, where African Americans were reluctant to vote for Antonio Villaraigosa. I think that when I wrote the book, and I in my introduction, I talk about the fact that I went to have a couple of drinks with a Chicano lawyer and a Latino lawyer, and there's a real distinction between the two. The Chicano lawyer was absolutely livid that I would even raise this as an issue, that it was divide and conquer. What was I doing exposing, private issues to the public, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And my point to him was very simple. I said, look, we have changing demographics. I think that the book is far more important for African Americans than it is for Latinos because it's really diminishing their power and their growth in California, and particularly but nationwide. So I think that to some degree, Latinos are uncomfortable with this new position. There was an editorial in the LA Times when the numbers came out by a fellow by the name of Rodriguez, who basically was apologizing the fact that we had now outstripped the African Americans in terms of numbers. The point is, they're just numbers. Latinos have, particularly Latino politicians, have an obligation to whatever state they represent, whatever district they represent, to represent everybody equally.
Earl Afari Hutchinson, what about African-American leaders in this regard? What sort of position ought they to be taking at this point?
Well, I think it should be a position of reaching out across the lines. I still submit at the end of the day, we can and we should talk about the tensions, the friction, hostility, differences. That's there. We shouldn't certainly sanitize any dirty laundry and sweep anything under the rug. But we still have some very, very pressing common issues. Police abuse, obviously, is still an issue that hits African Americans and Latinos. Obviously, even though there's friction over jobs, who gets what or doesn't get what, job discrimination is still a very, very important issue that impacts on African Americans and Latinos. Neighborhood services. Obviously, we live in many of the same communities now. Major issue. Healthcare.
Okay, Earl, I'm going to have to interrupt you, and I'm sorry, it's my fault. I asked you a question too late in the program, and we're out of time. We'll continue this conversation on future programs. Earl Afari Hutchinson and Nicholas Vaca. Thanks a lot to both of you for being
with
us.
Thank you. Thank
Producers
you.
Of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Jonah King, Sharon Rimbaugh, Managing Producer Cameron Radziner, Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.